You're listening to TIP.
All right, so on today's show, we bring back a popular guest, Dr. Wesley Gray. We first got introduced to Dr. Gray through a member of our mastermind group, Toby Carlisle, because they co-authored a book together, and the name of the book is Quantitative Value. The book is a popular read among value investors because it takes decades of data and provides clues into the best metrics to determine when companies are oversold and potentially undervalued. This is commonly called backtesting. The interesting thing about Dr. Gray is that he's also conducted extensive research into momentum investing as well. And so based on this research, both on the value investing side and on the momentum side, he has taken a really interesting way to invest, which is a hybrid approach to value and momentum. So on today's show, we're talking to Dr. Gray about some of the interesting trends he's finding in the market today. We also talk about areas where an investor can improve or challenge their current belief structure. And finally, Dr. Gray talks about the way he accounts for systematic risk and how he might hedge a market during challenging times.
You are listening to The Investors Podcast, where we study the financial markets and read the books that influence self-made billionaires the most. We keep you informed and prepared for the unexpected.
All right. So welcome back to the show, Wes. Man, we always have so much fun when you come on the show and chat because you always just have a tendency to show us different ways to look at things. So we are very excited to have you back on the show. Thanks for taking time out of your day to be with us.
It's always an honor. And I'm humbled to be here again.
Well, let's talk about, I'm sure everyone wants to kind of hear Wes Gray's opinion on where we're at in the market, because the last time I checked, this thing's starting to go parabolic, and I'm just kind of curious what you're thinking.
Sure. So there's a difference between what I'm thinking and what I actually do. because as you know, I am a quant nowadays.
So yeah.
I'm a fundamental dude wrapped in the quants, equilibrium here. So what I think is the markets are insanely overvalued and it's crazy. And I've been expecting to crash for 5 years now, but that hasn't happened. But that's why I don't think. I use machines, and we're big trend followers. So to the extent, markets are moving and trending, we own it, essentially buy and hold. So to the extent these markets keep trending, we're in. Valuation isn't relevant to how we think about owning beta risk, basically.
So, Wes, I guess what you're saying might come as a surprise to a lot of people who followed your early careers. I mean, you literally wrote a book about value investing. So, whenever you're saying you're doing trend following, is it only on value picks or is it basically on every pick out there, even though they have, say, high multiples?
Yep. So it's a great distinction to make clear. So, at the stock selection level, we're buying cheap, high quality, right? And right now, like in the US, the average EBIT yield on our stocks, which is kind of how we look at the market. So basically your operating income over your enterprise value, that basket's probably around 10 to 11 versus the market, which is around 5. So we're buying cheap stocks straight up because we're hardcore value investors, but embedded in any investment, unless you're market neutral, is the beta bet, right? If you're long stocks, whether they're cheap stocks, expensive stocks, or anything in between, if you have market risk embedded in there. And how we think about timing the market risk component of what we do is based on trend. So for example, we buy the cheapest dirtball stocks out there that we can find, and there's plenty of them even in today's markets. But how we think about whether we want to, be long only or hedged has nothing to do with valuations and everything about trend. So right now we're long, cheap, quality stocks, and we're not in a hedged position. We're not long, short, or market neutral.
So let me ask you this. So let's say the trend starts to shift. Let's say we're three months, 4 months later, or a year later, or whatever it is, and you start to see a statistical change in the trend. Mm-hmm. First of all, what would you like for the market to start saying, hey, this trend is over, or we think this trend is reversing? What are some of the things that you're looking at to be able to make that determination?
It's very simple. So we use basically two rules and we 50-50 them. And we got a 20-page blog post about it. But First one is just long-term moving average. Like, so the current price on S&P, like if we're talking about domestic markets, relative to the 12-month moving average, if it's above, great, keep owning value stocks and momentum stocks. If it's below, that signal says we need to be hedged. And then the other signal is, it's called time series momentum or absolute momentum. And we use, it's, you know, Gary Antonacci, if you guys are familiar with him, has a great book, Dual Momentum, where he kind of talks about this concept. And we use one element of dual momentum. It's just literally current cumulative return on S&P relative to the cumulative return on the, you know, T-bills, basically. If it's positive, in. Otherwise, you're hedged. And so we have those two signals. We'll assess them every month. If, you know, both say good to go, we stay long whatever we're owning. If they're 50-50, we're 50% hedged. And if they're both say, hey, you know, it's time to jump off a bridge, then we'll fully hedge the portfolio, basically.
And you're completely short at that point.
Yeah. So we'll be long. We're always long value and momentum names, but we'll start layering down passive shorts like SPY or EFA, or we'll use futures to kind of pull out the beta component of the bet. So we'll essentially be market neutral.
So what are the numbers for this past month when you did the analysis, just so the audience can kind of understand what you mean by what you're saying there in actual numbers?
Sure. So I don't have the exact, you know, figures at the top of my tongue here, but
yeah.
there has not been a trend break in either international or US equity for, I think, at least a year and a half at this point. And that makes sense because obviously we've been in a massive trend. And so we would have to have a fairly substantial crash, and it'd have to happen fairly quickly and robustly to hit a trend rule, basically.
Now, why do you use 1 year moving average? Why not 200 days, 100 days, or say 50 days moving average?
So basically, it doesn't really matter. Out of sample, whatever we're using currently is almost, there's 100% probably it's not going to be the, you know, the one we should have used. But all we know is that ex ante and all the research we've done on this, as long as you're in the general genre of long-term trend, you could do 200 day, you could do, you know, 356.25 days. We don't really care. They're all about the same. There's a lot of noise around the signal, but it is robust to the concept. So we just use that because it's simple, it's easy to communicate, and it's in the ballpark of, you know, it's evidence-based. So that's what we stick to. But there's no science. That's more the art of quant signals.
I would think that you would get yourself into long-term gains. You would limit your short-term gains by going with a longer moving average, like a year long. Like if you were at a 60-day moving average, I would think that you would incur a lot of short-term gains because you're constantly buying and selling as it would move in and out of that average. Is that correct? Is that a better?
That's correct. And, you know, it really depends. Like, trend following is not an end-all be-all. And for all intents and purposes, a long-term trend following metric is basically buy and hold because it's long trend. And so you are kind of a buy and holder most of the time. And if you do shorter trend models, like the time the market, to your point, you know, it's much more reactive, but it's also going to cost you a lot more in frictional costs, taxes. And it's unclear to me it's any better for what we're looking at, which is tail risk protection versus a long-term one. So why not use the one that, you know, is not as crazy and causes you as much brain damage all the time you use it?
So this can be applied when you're doing this stuff. I mean, because you're really talking just straight price action is what you're paying attention to for hedging yourself.
Yeah, just to be clear on that, because I understand what I'm saying is heresy to, you know, fundamental value investors, which, you know, I still am that person, that shell of a person I used to be. So what's important to understand here is that, like, there's a difference between using value to pick individual securities. And when you're picking individual stocks, you want to be cheap and stay cheap, right? But then when you start getting into the world of macro and timing market risk, i.e. overall market valuations, there is no evidence that I know of that's very robust that suggests that just because I know today that the market's at a 99 percentile valuation metric, that it can somehow tactically help me outperform, like basically a generic buy and hold proposition. And we've tried a million different ways to cut that cake. It's just empirical fact. Here's what we do know. The one thing that can help you improve, you know, your risk return profile relative to buy and hold is trend. And what's really important is that trend is what you want to pay attention to, especially when valuations are top heavy. So you don't want to time your allocations based on valuation alone, but to the extent that the trend sucks and valuations are high, that's when you definitely want to get the hell away from the market if you want to take the risk of, you know, market timing, which I'm not saying it's perfect, but if you wanted to do it, that would be the recipe for success, at least historically. Hmm.
Do you find yourself participating in other markets? So we've seen that commodities have just been crushed for the last 3 or 4 years. That's had a very bottoming effect over the last year where they've been really flat. And you've seen oil come back quite a bit recently. So I'm curious, are you seeing a reversal? Do you participate in other markets outside of equities, call it commodities? And if so, I'm kind of curious to hear your thoughts on that trend reversing at this point, because it appears, and you talk to a lot of macro people, they're all saying that they're seeing a reversal in the commodities sector.
Sure. So yes, we basically trade or have traded anything that you can possibly trade. And so beside our equity business, we are a CTA and a CPO, and we trade managed futures. So we trade every future on the planet, basically. And again, there, we are focused on trend and then the carry trade. So looking at backwardation contango. So, and obviously, you know, the trend, was kind of mixed and all over the place. But recently, you know, you're pretty much long most of the commodity complex, especially in energy and the metals. And it's also backwards in the energy complex, which hasn't happened in, you know, God knows how long. So,
yeah.
I mean, from a quant perspective, it's great. And even from a qualitative perspective, if I can own, you know, trending contracts that are also tend to be backwards versus contango, so I capture roll yield, I mean, the wind is, you know, at your back finally versus what it has been in the past.
Explain to the audience the backwardation piece here, because some people might not be familiar with what you're saying there.
Sure. So in futures contracts, you know, essentially your return is determined not really just necessarily by the spot movement, but also by kind of the what they call the term structure of the future. And so to the extent that the spot price is above the future price, that means the future's in backwardation. So what's going to happen is over time, the future is going to roll up to the spot price, right? So, and it's called capturing kind of the roll yield. Whereas if you buy, if the current spot is below the future price and you buy the future, that future price will slowly kind of decay down to the spot price, which means you got negative roll. And historically, at least in like oil futures, for example, like last 10, 15 years, you've always been, because you don't own a barrel of oil, you own a future in oil typically, right? When you buy any sort of investment product out there. And so you kind of own obviously the risk of the spot price that comes into play. And just like, or like I say, in our last recent memory, oil contracts has always been contango. So you not only need oil price to move up to win, you also need it to overcome the negative roll yield that you've been facing recently. But now, let's just say the spot price stays the same, you're still going to have a positive return on that investment because now you're capturing roll yield that's positive, which is cool.
Awesome.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
The dream of owning a vacation home can be daunting. From finding the best guests, to the maintenance, to organizing the cleaners after every guest stay. With Vacasa, they make that dream into a reality. As a full-service vacation home management company with vacation homes in key destinations across the U.S., they know how to make owning a vacation home easy and profitable. On top of proactive property maintenance visits by professional local teams, a data-driven booking platform, and around-the-clock support, homeowners earn on average 20% or more revenue from their vacation homes. Vacasa makes vacation home ownership easy. If you're looking to make more from your vacation home by doing less, Partner with Vacasa at vacasa.com. That's vacasa.com to get started on your dream of owning a vacation home. Have you ever wondered if there's an AI tool like ChatGPT specifically built for the stock market? A tool that not only aids you in your research and analysis process, but also allows for dynamic discussions? Today, I want to share such a tool with you called Meka. Meka is the AI-powered stock research assistant now enhanced with real-time stock data. Meka does a lot of the heavy lifting of sifting through financial statements and company data and delivers it to you nearly instantaneously, and the best part is that it's 100% free. Try it out today and ask Meka questions like, what is the financial health of Microsoft? How much cash does Copart hold on its balance sheet? What is the return on invested capital of Adobe, or millions of other prompts? Check it out today for free at Meka.com. That's Meyka.com. Today's episode is sponsored by Range Rover Sport. Range Rover Sport leads by example with their dynamic design that rises to the occasion. It's got powerful on-road performance and commanding all-terrain capabilities, coupled with signature Range Rover refinement. The third-generation Range Rover Sport is the most desirable, advanced, and dynamically capable one yet, redefining sporting luxury. It's got advanced cabin technologies such as active noise cancellation and cabin air purification, offering next-level comfort and refinement. The purposeful cockpit light driving position sets the tone for a focused interior that promotes exhilarating driver engagement. Award-winning Pivi Pro infotainment is at the heart of the experience and provides intuitive control of the vehicle systems. You can enjoy a dynamic drive and total comfort with optional 22-way adjustable heated and ventilated electric memory front seats with massage function. Design your Range Rover Sport at LandRoverUSA.com. That's LandRoverUSA.com.
All right, back to the show.
Would you say that there's statistical significance behind the momentum change in commodities in general, or would you just say that you're starting to see it break through some of the moving averages that you track?
Yeah, so for sure. So we run both long trend models, which are basically like 12-month type ideas.
Yeah.
And we also run like a short-term one that's much more, you know, high frequency. And it's a 10-100 crossover type model. So it's, you literally compare like the 10-day versus 100-day. But if you look at like the energy sector, for example, I mean, it's pretty much raging on everything. I mean, it's like, I don't even know, it's priced 70 bucks, 65 bucks right now or something, depending on which contract you look at. So I mean, it's all signs are green from a trend perspective. And right now on a carry perspective, same thing with the equity, like valuation-based timing on commodities is a noisy, tough game. But, you know, if you put a gun to my head and said, hey, are commodities a better bet now than they were, you know, 3 or 4 years ago when they were the coolest thing, you know, since sliced bread, I'd say probably better now because everyone hates them and they got trend and they're backward. So, you know, the natural, being a contrarian in me, you know, I'd say commodities seem to be an interesting place to be at.
Yeah. Jeff Gundlach. I mean, he's really tooting that horn. I mean, he's screaming, that's the play of 2018 is commodities.
So. Yeah. Well, I mean, I'll tell you what, man, like in our managed futures program, again, it's just a quant system, but this thing's kind of built for crisis alpha. So it's kind of saying we're probably moving to an inflation world by saying we're short the entire, you know, sovereign bond complex. And we're kind of long a lot of the metals and energy sector. There's a mixed signal in kind of like the wheats and the softs right now. But in general, I'd say it's saying, hey, if there's going to be a crisis or a surprise, it's going to be an inflationary surprise, not a deflationary surprise.
Yeah.
At least that's what's being shown in kind of managed futures land at the moment.
So you briefly hit on this, and it really takes me to the next point that Preston and I wanted to cover. How do you look at the bond prices right now and the trend there? Because at least some of the billionaires that we follow have made some really crazy predictions of what's going to happen.
Yeah, I don't know what the billionaires are saying, but I do know that a lot of billionaires have lost a lot of money over the last 4 to 5 years because they've been saying that, you know, yields are going to go up forever now, and they've been wrong. However, that's why we don't think we're billionaires. We just follow models. And right now is finally a point in time where, you know, long duration, credit, or not credit, but long duration sovereign bonds, the trend sucks. And so we're starting to get short. And so now it's a situation where they've been arguably overvalued forever. But as I mentioned, that's not a great timing mechanism. It's a sucker bet. However, when you have assets that have terrible trend and you have a sense that they're systematically overvalued, now might be the time to say, hey, maybe fixed income, is not really a great place to be.
So on the short end of that, at least 10 years and shorter, there might be a reversion happening. I don't know if you see this the same way, Wes, or if your models would tell you otherwise. So I'm very curious about your opinion on this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we track all the 10-year sovereign bonds across the globe, Graham, and they're literally across the board short, which means they all have terrible trend, i.e. the prices have been going down because the rates have been, ballooning. So if you're someone who's a long-term bond bear, the trend is kind of confirming that. And I'd say if you're going to time that bet and, take risk out of that bucket, this would be the time where it probably makes sense versus, last few years where it's been, getting in front of a steamroller basically.
So if all that money's coming out of the bond market, let's just say that theory is true and that trend persists and it moves forward for the next 6 months and all that money comes out of the bond market.
Well, I mean, in general, there's always equilibrium, right? So even when bonds are getting sold, someone's buying them. So the money's still there. It's just someone else is owning it. So I'm not, that's actually a really, it sounds like a simple question, but that's actually a really tough question. And frankly, I don't know.
The thing I like to ask really smart people like yourself every time I get a chance to talk with you is at least for the last quarter has been commodities, because they've been just punished so badly over the last three years, where everything else has just performed so well. And then we're seeing the bond market start to turn itself inside out. So, and I mean, when you see the equity market going parabolic, you're exactly right. This trend has not been broken whatsoever. This thing is still going strong and it might keep going strong.
Yeah, you got it. And you've kind of hit on what I call poor man's managed futures. What I would recommend is if I wasn't going to do a 60-40, because, my advisor is just telling me that and charging me 1% to do that, even though it's bad advice. For my 40, I would say, listen, I don't know if we're going hyperinflation or hyperdeflation, but I do know that commodities and long duration bonds are kind of the barbell trade amongst those.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to trend follow. Mm-hmm. So if commodities start getting perked up a trend, I'm going to, and treasuries are not, I'm going to start moving in commodities for my diversifier and away from duration bonds. And then vice versa, if the trend, tends to drift the other way. And that right there is kind of a, if you wanted to have a simple 60-40, but have protection in that 40, that's not just deflation asset protection. Yeah, you'd want to use commodities and bonds and just trend follow them across whatever one's working best.
So how does the tax cut play into this? I mean, is giving the stocks, it seems like a lot of momentum. Is the market so much in momentum that it doesn't really add anything, or how do you guys look at it?
When we're talking about macro level stuff, we focus on trend exclusively. To the extent, and obviously that's in the price. Like the market's telling you this is worth a lot, which is why prices keep moving up. So we'll just be in that trend, because it's probably the case that I imagine the markets don't even fully appreciate just how big that could be. Now, but that's just also pontificating there, and that we just focus on momentum. Now, at the individual stock level, like in value land, the reason you buy cheap with margin of safety is you bought cheap with margin of safety, and anything that could potentially be good has a huge spike. So that tax bill was great for value people, because value guys are buying dirtball retailers and people that tend to pay a lot of high marginal tax rates. And they just basically got their net income doubled, because they go from whatever, a 40% marginal to 20. I mean, that's a big deal, which is why like a lot of the kind of securities we've owned, which have been sucking wind, have just, they're on a ripping tear. But that's more a function of just, if you buy cheap with margin of safety and the winds shift and you get lucky, when they bounce back with that news, which in this case was favorable, they go ripping. But I could have never predicted that, and I didn't. I just my only thing is just buy cheap, and that works. So other than that, we don't really incorporate it into our DOP processes that much, to be honest.
So Wes, I want to talk about one of your ETFs. Wes has a, your company has an ETF. It's QVAL, QVAL. And this is, correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm explaining this wrong, but this ETF is basically purely based off of your book Quantitative Value that you did with Toby Carlyle, as far as EBIT to enterprise value is how this is making its selections. Is that correct?
Yeah, for all intents and purposes of the big muscle movements, you got it. And it's buy the cheapest, highest quality stocks. Hold with conviction, don't closet index. And the cheapest is, to your point, enterprise multiples. And that's kind of the core driver of what we do. But then within the cheapest dirt balls, we obviously want to identify the highest quality of the cheapest. So, and this is an area where I think there's a little bit of disagreement probably with Toby, but you know, where we kind of like cheap, but we also do want to have an element of quality in there. Mm-hmm. But I mean,
where Toby just likes it cheap.
Yeah, he just likes
it.
I like it cheap too. But I am a believer that, you know, cheap with you got to be cheap, but add a look quality element in there is also, at least for our context, important. But, you know, if you just buy cheap too, that's also perfectly reasonable approach. Just, you know, different strokes for different folks, I guess.
So it's interesting because whenever I look at the performance of this compared to the S&P for the last year, you guys have outperformed the S&P 500 with this thing. But if I go back to inception from whenever it first started, you guys are underperforming because you went through this period in 2015 that was just, it was really strange. Like you can see that everything is very closely correlated for the most part to the S&P 500, except for this one little tiny spot in 2015 through really kind of the second half of 2015. And if it wasn't for that, you guys would be beating it since inception. I'm just curious if you know, like, what is there a way that you can explain what happened in during that 6 month period of time, or is it just how the numbers shake out sometimes?
So, so to give you a little further history, so that QV strategy, we've actually been running for 5 years because we got that seed in SMAs in 2012, and so we've always done this concentrated value strategy. We launched that like at the end of 2012, and it went on an like all deep value guys, it went on an epic rager, right? It was like, we were amazing. And then we got this bright idea for tax reasons, like, hey, we should launch this whole ETF deal. And of course, you know, I have perfect timing in my life. I also launched a hedge fund back in the day, September 08. We launched this ETF in late 2014, about 5 months before one of the most epic drawdowns ever in the EBIT, you know, value factor, killed by, you know, a lot of just, you know, in the path of Amazon's war machine, where just, yeah, being in bad retail bets, what have you. But it just so happens that the ETF came up and a track record just started, you know, at kind of the pinnacle right before it about, you know, collapsed. And then to your point, like the last year, you know, it's been on an epic rager where it's like destroyed the S&P. But that's just the nature of value. You're going to look like a total genius sometimes. You're going to look like the biggest idiot on the planet sometimes. And the only thing we know is you got to just hold for a long haul and be willing to be very different if you plan on, you know, having even a chance of winning over the long haul. And you've seen that empirically in the QV system.
I'm curious if you have an ETF that you'd be looking that would do kind of a hedging strategy. Is that something that you can even do with an ETF? Can you? I don't know this.
You can. So, I mean, we run one that has like a trend following component to it, where it's, you know, it's long, you know, the securities, but to the extent the trend starts not doing great, we'll start layering and hedge. It'll kind of move towards like a market neutral stance. So it's kind of like a hedge fund strategy, basically in, you know, an ETF wrapper, which again, we do that for tax reasons.
But it doesn't, do inverses at that point. It won't go.
No, it doesn't do inverse. It literally shorts, because inverse is basically too expensive, capital inefficient, and frankly, in my opinion, just stupid. I understand why people sometimes do it in an IRA, because you're not really allowed to short, but it's much more cost effective if you want to hedge to either short, sell a future or sell like SPY short, as opposed to buying an inverse, because that's what they're basically doing, but they're charging you like, you know, whatever it is, 1%. And just, yeah, it's just not a smart idea. It's much better to do it, you know, directly. And there's a few, there's, you know, Pacer ETFs has some pretty cool products that can go to hedge status. I think you're going to start seeing that. That's going to be a new frontier where right now in ETF land, kind of the product innovation's always been, you know, originally it was just closet indexing. And then they had a little small smart beta factor tilt, but basically closet indexing. We kind of led the frontier on doing concentrated factors. And I think the next frontier is going to be kind of basically moving all the hedge fund type strategies and their kind of unique risk profiles into the ETF wrapper, which is, you know, going to be great because it'll be tax efficient and more accessible at cheaper costs for, you know, a broader base of investors out there.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in over 20 strategic locations. They have extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com. As someone who's constantly on the road and traveling, Briggs & Riley has been a game changer that ensures my travel experience is phenomenal. I'm a satisfied customer of Briggs & Riley myself, and I can certainly tell you that their luggage performs. It's extremely durable, it has amazing features that make packing and getting around easier, and they have the best lifetime guarantee in the industry. If your bag is ever broken or damaged, they'll repair it free of charge, no questions asked, even if your airline damages the bag. They also just released their Simpatico collection of hard-sided luggage. It has this new one-touch feature which allows you to expand your luggage, pack it, then compress it to its original size so a carry-on can still fit in the overhead compartment, plus many other cool features. If you want luggage that was awarded the best carry-on by Forbes, then now's the time to get it. Get your new and improved luggage at Briggs-Riley.com. That's Briggs-Riley.com. Looking to part ways with complicated, expensive, and uncertain shipping? Then give your business the edge it needs with USPS Ground Advantage shipping from the United States Postal Service. Keep everything simple with clear, upfront pricing and no unexpected surcharges. Keep things affordable with some of the lowest prices out there. And keep it all reliable with on-time ground shipments. It's time to turn shipping to your advantage. Learn how at USPS.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable.
All right, back to the show.
So let's take a step back from the big markets and the big movements in the markets that we're seeing right now and talk about the individual invest. And perhaps they're just starting to get their feet wet. What do you think, Wes, with your experience, is the two biggest mistakes that you typically see this investor conduct? And what can they do to correct them?
The biggest one is just the too good to be true problem. It is a lot of people that get into investing, they get real excited. And like Bitcoin is a great example. They're like, oh, this is easy. You know, you just buy this thing, it goes up 1,000%. So just the number one mistake is just not understanding that when you go into a market, you are fighting with grizzly bears and 200 IQ people. You know, IQ people that, you know, they're trying to feed their kids. So it's super competitive, super hardcore, and going in with the expectation it's going to be easy or there's some, you know, kind of magic free lunch out there, I think is the number one mistake. And then kind of on the flip side of that, the number two mistake is that if you want to be disciplined, if you've got the right temperament, and if you've got the kind of emotional capability to, you know, not succumb to crazy behavioral biases, to assume that you can't beat the market. So it's kind of an irony. Like, on one hand, assuming you can beat the market and it's easy money and, you know, it's everything's too good to be true, let's just do it. That's one problem. But on the flip side, if you do have the temperament, just assuming that the market's perfectly efficient and you know, what's the point is also kind of stupid, you know, if you have the temperament. So those are kind of flip sides of the same coin, but they represent two mistakes that a lot of people just get in the business or just starting succumb to, I think.
So to take this discussion further, say that you have this camp of hardcore value investors, you know, the Warren Buffett investing philosophy type, you know, they're looking straight at the fundamentals, you know, like Preston and I are doing, and perhaps not looking too much at the momentum, the trend, and what's happening in your alley. What is our biggest mistake in not considering your vantage point?
Well, so first off, just want to clarify that just because I personally believe in momentum and trend, I don't, that's something that I understand that process. I have the confidence in it, and because I have the confidence in it, I personally have the emotional ability to stick to it, but it is totally inappropriate for people that just think it's total baloney. So that's cool. And it's not me telling that's what people should do. It's just, that's what I do. It's not appropriate for everyone. So it's kind of a tough question, because if you're a value investor that thinks that everything I just mentioned about trend and momentum is total, you know, horse manure, that's totally fine. In some sense, you could argue it's a mistake, because based on the evidence, it's very clear that these are probably ideas that are just as well evidence-based and, you know, ingrained in the marketplace as deep value investing is. But on the flip side of that, because you're not confident, because you think it's baloney, it also would be a mistake to do it. So it's kind of like this weird irony where on one hand, they're wrong because it's just the facts of life. But on the other hand, because given you think it's wrong, it would also be wrong to actually do the strategy, because the minute they started doing it, they'd be like, oh, see, it stopped working. I knew he was the God and wrote the Bible and you're not supposed to do this stuff. And these guys are stupid. And then you sell out. And of course, you're going to do it the wrong time. So it really, it all boils down to what's your temperament for the process that you're following. And if you can't stick to it, then just don't do it.
So it's interesting, because I was going to ask you what the mistake that a lot of momentum guys that are just strictly momentum traders, what would be their mistake? And I'd imagine you'd answer it the exact same way, that they don't have fundamentals into their approach. But it's also the irony involved with that. Would you agree? It's just the inverse of what you just said?
Exactly. Huh. The bottom line is everyone's got great ideas, but people get emotionally attached to their ideas, so it prevents them from kind of thinking outside the box. But once they become emotional about ideas that are outside their box, that's also where the behavioral problems come in. So it's like this kind of circular logic where, okay, you weren't smart enough to realize that you should be doing it, but because you're not smart enough to realize that you should be doing it, and that because you have an emotional attachment to some other religion, if you were to go do it, you would actually end up, you know, screwing yourself up anyway. So it's kind of like a what they call like a second best equilibrium outcome, where first best would just be purely evidence-based, do what the data say, do what gives you the best chance of, you know, long run after tax, after fee compounding. But that's not reality for most people. So then it's the second best solution of, given your behavioral problems, what optimizes? And that's what most people do, which is cool.
Awesome. Hey, I was looking around on your site recently, and I see that you have a new tool platform where people can filter results based off of EBIT to enterprise value, which I know is a very useful metric for trying to find undervalued companies. But it seems like your filter does this for ETFs. Is that correct? Or does it do it for individual companies as well?
So built this tool, it's in beta right now. If you go to newtools.alphaarchitect.com, you can sign up. You have to verify you're a financial professional. And so to the extent you deem that you have that labeled, and go for it, it's free. But what we're trying to solve for there is, making sure that people understand what they're buying and why they're buying it. So it basically gives you deep x-ray look into the underlying holdings of ETFs, where you can, like, if someone says, hey, I'm a value fund, well, let's go sort your securities and look at how every individual security maps out on value. Like, did you actually buy cheap stuff or were you just closet indexing? You know, this tool will be able to directly analyze that. And you can also, I don't know if you even had a chance to look at it, but if you can click on individual securities in an ETF portfolio, it'll drill down to the stock level and give you all the factor analysis and give you like, hey, what does this thing rank on enterprise multiples or price to book or whatever the heck it is. So it's meant for folks that are looking at ETFs, but if you're an individual stock person, you can look at an ETF and if it owns a security you're interested in, click on it and it'll drill down to that level of detail.
Well, what I like about this, Wes, is when you go and you do research on, you know, Yahoo Finance or a lot of these different platforms and you're looking specifically at an ETF, it's really kind of hard to maybe find some of the information on even a PE ratio. Sometimes you can't even find out what the PE ratio is for an ETF. But looking at your tool here, this is incredible because you guys have a lot of data.
Yeah, we think it's going to be kind of life-changing and from a transparency standpoint. And we're trying to keep an open architecture where if you look at that tool, like we don't care if you're a value, vol investor, momentum investor, we have like 20 or 30 different characteristics that you can analyze based on the holdings and all the data is there. So if you look at a fund, it'll spit out its holdings and the different parameters and what they rank on. Whatever you believe in, whatever factor or characteristic that you think matters for your, you know, livelihood of investing, it gives you basically the forensic details on that at the holdings level for any ETF that's at this point US traded long only. We're going to add mutual funds here, but just the engineering on this is kind of a non-trivial thing.
All right. So Wes, last time we had you on, we played a question from the audience and we got your feedback from the questioner. You answered the question. So today we're going to do that again. This question comes from Nate. He's out in Silicon Valley and here's his question.
Hi, this is Nate. And first, just wanted to say thank you so much for putting on this podcast. I've learned a ton from listening to you guys. And thank you very much for putting this up every week. I've found that when learning something new, you need to start by building a foundational knowledge base, like a strong, basal understanding of how the fundamentals work. Then as you learn new things, because you already have this foundation, you know exactly where to put any new knowledge, and you can see how it relates to everything else. As someone who is fairly new to investing, I've learned a lot of things that are point learnings, but I haven't yet formed a foundational knowledge base upon which to build and place each of these point learnings. What would you recommend as the best way, aside from your podcast, to build that initial foundational knowledge base, both for investing knowledge and for broader macroeconomic knowledge? Thanks.
All right. So Wes, fantastic question, by the way. I really like this question, but I want to hear what you think.
Yeah, I concur, Press. I think it's a great question. And, you know, I don't think it has a simple answer because you could take it many different ways. But I'd say if you want to get in the weeds on the micro components of, you know, fundamental valuation or stock selection, you know, unfortunately, you got to go to the dig in the well and, you know, stick to things like security analysis, intelligent investor, even though I know they're, you know, seem like they're two old books and, you know, they're for old guys. But I think that's just a great baseline fundamental framework for, you know, figuring out how to value a stock like the classic methods. Now, once you move beyond kind of the micro on valuation, you know, if you Google around, there's probably 100 resources. You know, I know Preston Stig, they have a great, you know, course on their website. Khan Academy almost certainly has great resources. And there's this good old thing called Google. I think a lot of times Googling around, the machines have kind of optimized on, you know, if you answer the right question with enough detail, a lot of times the best resources will bubble to the top. And I'd stick to that because it's free. Probably a good place to start.
So I completely agree with Wes on the security analysis, Benjamin Graham, all that kind of stuff is really good for the micro level. I think for a person who's coming into this fairly new, security analysis is probably going to be a little difficult to go through. Depending on if you've had business classes or what, like how much accounting experience you have might make it difficult.
You need to get accounting. And well, and here's another thing. If you're coming in new to investing, I mean, frankly, it probably means you're not going to be like a stock picker. Like that means you're becoming a professional. So if you're coming in new, it's really about more high level frameworks. Like we have the facts framework, like know the fees, know your liquidity, know the complexity, the taxes, because you're probably going to end up just buying a Vanguard fund anyways. It's, you know, so really if you're going to get into the micro weeds, the reality is it's painful and it requires you to basically read that kind of stuff
a lot.
So it just is what it is. So if you don't want to be a professional or someone who's like dedicates their life to the trade, and you're really just kind of someone who wants to learn about investing and how you're going to allocate your portfolio down the road, you know, you may not even want to go into that level of detail because it's just going to make your head spin and it's not going to be worth it. And that's what I was saying, just probably.
I'm curious about this, Wes, and I know I'm changing gears away from the question, but we were talking with Shane Parrish, and I asked Shane if he had a choice between the intelligent investor or margin of safety. You know, if he had to pick one or the other, which one would he pick?
Yeah.
And he said margin of safety. And I tend to agree with him. I'm kind of curious if you enjoyed that book as much as we liked it.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. But the problem is to buy that book's like $1,000. That one's more like the access. But yeah, Seth Klarman's much better at, I think, exposition and kind of storyboarding it where it's more tangible. Where intelligent investor is boring as hell, frankly. But, you know, it's like eating your Brussels sprouts. Sometimes the things that are good for you aren't exactly easy or fun, but they're still good for you. So I'm a big fan of, you know, big fan of it. But you're right, margin safety is also a great resource to the extent you can access the manuscript somehow.
I guess for me, when it comes to micro, I mean, obviously you can have and find books that's very quantitative and you have a lot of key ratios to look at and a lot of accounting to look at. One of the most recent books that we read was called How the Mighty Fall by Jim Collins, which is, I wouldn't say it's the complete opposite of what you suggested, Wes. There are a few key ratios in there, but it's a very different approach to understanding why companies fail, which is, at least in my opinion, one of the best approaches to understand, on the flip side, why companies are successful and why you want to invest in them. And not only in terms of making the acquisition of the stock, but also to follow the progress and not just look at the numbers, but also look what's behind the numbers and perhaps considering when you should sell.
To answer his question about macro, I had I think that one of the most profound reads that I've ever had on macro came off of Ray Dalio's website. I'll put a link to it in the show notes, but Ray lays out his principles for basically macro and the way that he thinks about it. And a lot of it is based off of the video that I'm sure most people know about by now. There's a 30-minute video that he has on YouTube about like how the economic machine works. I would highly recommend you watch that. We'll put the video into the show notes as well. But the PDF that goes along with that, I want to say it's like a 250-page white paper on his opinion on how macro works and how it all fits together. That is hands down the best thing that I've ever read on macro that's out there. And we'll have that all for free in the show notes if you guys want to check that out as well. So
I'll second that motion, because I agree that that guy's obviously a genius and you should probably read whatever he writes.
Yeah.
And that the economic machine piece is amazing.
Yeah. So Nate, thank you so much for this really awesome question. We really enjoyed talking about this one. As a token of our appreciation for submitting your question, we want to give you our Intrinsic Value Investment course, which can be found on our TIP Academy page. This is a paid course, but because you asked such a great question, you'll get it completely for free. So if anyone else out there wants to get their question played on the show and get a free course, just go to asktheinvestors.com and you can record your questions there. So Wes, thanks for coming on the show. I always have so much fun. And you know what? I want to thank you so much. We did a event in New York back in August. And I just want to say this publicly, because that event would have never happened without Wes Gray. Wes, you came to my rescue helping orchestrate it. We were able to have it at the CFA. That was all because of Wes putting me in contact with the right people and just helping me organize it. You always come through and always help us out so much. So I just wanted to thank you for that, Wes. And I want to give you the opportunity to just tell our audience where they can learn more about you,
you know, back to that event, I was just hooking up with some connections, but I thought that was amazing, man. You rallied a great group, super entertaining. And that signed book by Munger, I got a signed book collection, and that's one I thought I'd never get. And I was like, you gotta be kidding me. So, I mean, that was freaking awesome, man. Humbled and, you know, honored to participate. As far as us, so we've got, the three books, DIY Financial Advisor, Quantitative Value and Quantitative Momentum. The two, Quant Value, Quant Momentum, are a little bit hardcore if you're, haven't been doing finance for a while, but, go for it if you want a challenge. And then we have our blog, alphaarchitect.com. Our firm mission is empower through education. So we're not going to sell you anything. We're just trying to help people out. And we hope that's reflected in, amount of content and all the free resources we give to folks out there.
I really want people to remember this, because that ETF tool we were talking about earlier, I'm going to have a link in the show notes for that. This thing is awesome. You guys really need to check it out. It's completely free. It's 100% free. So check it out. I think you're going to be pretty impressed when you start playing around with it.
With respect to that tool, feel free to reach out. Like we're just trying to, get better all the time. So to the extent you're trying to break that thing and you find something, broken or man, I wish it had this, just let us know. Cause we want to actively be making that thing the best tool on the web for, people that want to get transparency on what they're buying.
All right. Well, Wes Gray, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's always such a pleasure to have you here, and we really appreciate it.
Always, always enjoy it.
So guys, I wanted to conclude this episode by telling you about our community event that we're having alongside with the Berkshire Hathaway shareholders meeting. So this is open to anyone that wants to attend, and we always have such an incredible time together. You don't need to own a $325,000 share of Berkshire A to attend. We explain exactly how you can do it on our website, so don't worry about that. Warren and Charlie aren't getting any younger, and the time to see them is right now. We have plenty of people that come to the event all by themselves, but the common thing that we hear is that it was so easy for everyone to make friends, and they had so much fun with all the other TIPers that attend the meeting. We do everything together so you won't miss anything or you won't feel left out. If you'd like to attend this meeting with Stig, myself, and some of the guests that we have on the show, simply go to tipberkshire.com. We bought the domain and we have it pointed to an information page where you can sign up and you can learn exactly what you need to do to attend the meeting. So let me repeat the address so you don't forget it. It's tipberkshire.com. We would love to hang out with you, so come and join us.
That was all that Preston and I had for this week's episode of the Investors Podcast. We see each other again next week.
Thanks for listening to TIP. To access the show notes, courses, or forums, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. To get your questions played on the show, go to asktheinvestors.com and win a free subscription to any of our courses on TIP Academy. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making investment decisions, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the TIP Network. Written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting. TIP.